Śrīmad-Bhāgavatam-yena tasmai śrī-gurave namaha sarva-śruti-śiro-ratma-virājita-padāmbujaha vedāntāmbuja-suryo-yaha tasmai śrī-gurave namaha caitanya-śāśvata-śāntaha Vyomatito Niranjanaha Bindunadakalatitaha Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Jnana Shakti Samarudhaha Tattva Mala Vibhushitaha Bhukti Mukti Pradata Cha Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Aneka Janma Samprapta Karma Bandha Vidahine Atma Jnana Pradahine Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shoshanam Bhavasindusha Nyapanam sarasampadaha Guru-padurkam samyake Tasmai Shri-gurave namaha Na guru-radikam tattvam Na guru-radikam tapaha Tattva-jnana-param nasti Tasmai Shri-gurave namaha Manata Shri Jagannataha Matkuru Shri Jagatkuru Maratma Sarva Bhutatma Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Guru Radhina Nadischa Guru Paramadairatam Guru Paramaram Nasti Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Om Brahmanandam Paramasukadam Kevalam Jnanamurtim Tvandvaditam Gaganasadrisham Tattvamasyadilakshyam Ekam Nityam Vimalam Achalam Sarvadisakshibhutam Bhavatitam Trigunarahitam Sadgurum tam namami Om Tameva mata chapita Tameva Tameva bandushka saka Tameva Tameva vidya dravinam Tameva Tameva sarvam Mama Deva Deva Tvameva Sarvam Mama Deva Deva
Sahana bhunaktu Saha viryam karavavahai Tejasvinavati tamastu mavidvishavahai Om shanti shanti shanti
These are melting up. When I'm aware of my thoughts and emotions, that is the buddhi, witnessing them. Not exactly. We say that, you know, there are, in the antakarana, karana means an instrument, anta means antaha, antara, antakarana. It means inner instrument. That's the technical word for the mind. The mind means the whole mind, which has four basic categories of thoughts, all of which are sattva. Any vritti is sattva. That means any vritti is illumined by consciousness, whether it be a manas, which can be in the form of an emotion, the negative emotions, or it can be just the fluctuating doubts, or it can be the buddhi, which is that category of thoughts which has decisive, clear thinking. And the buddhi, for instance, in inner child works and will kind of invoke the buddhi to go in as an inner friend to be with the little ones, because there's clarity and determination there on the part of the buddhi. Or the buddhi can be that category of thoughts that is responding to or handling an emotion. But it's both the emotion is illumined because vritti, and so in that sense is illumined by the witness, witness consciousness, or however we want to call that. But also the buddhi is, and the citta, the mind also. I mean, the memories also, and the ahankara. So any vritti, and there's four categories of vritti, so you could subcategorize them also, I suppose, but these are the four major categories. All of them are vrittis, all of them are sattva, and so all of them are illumined by consciousness, as opposed to saying here that when I'm aware of my thoughts and emotions, and that is the buddhi witnessing them. No, each one of them is illumined by consciousness. But what makes the buddhi different than, say, the manas is that the buddhi, in a sense, is innermost. And it has the capacity of coming in. It's a thought that has the capacity of coming into relationship. This thought, which is illumined, has the capacity to come into relationship with the manas or the memory, or the memory which itself is not having any function. It's just an illumined, like an illumined emotion or an illumined perception or illumined memory. But the buddhi, which is also illumined, its function, its clarity of thinking or determinative thinking, can objectify these other types of thoughts. So the ahankara also is considered like the buddhi. It's also a function of the buddhi, and it is more determinative than something that's just simply an experience. The manas is more an experience, the buddhi comes into relation. Both are thoughts, though. When we use the word witnessing consciousness or something like that, we only mean the self, from if that makes sense. What you're thinking of, though, I understand the point, I think, of the question, and that is, of the different types of vrittis, it's the buddhi that can come into relationship with the manas. The one like emotion doesn't come into relationship with another emotion. So the buddhi comes into relationship with a given emotion and then talks to it nicely or helps it in one way or another and helps that emotion to calm down, that type of thing. So I think that, I hope that's clear.
So let's say like someone who would say like a crazy person,
yeah,
whose buddhi is so out of whack, then when there's an emotion, there's no buddhi that can like see it and maybe calm it down or talk to it or something like that.
Yeah, like say you mean somebody who's delusional or is maybe perhaps schizophrenic.
Yeah.
And when a person is like that, if we want to use kind of Vedanta language for it, it's like the ahankara or the buddhi has totally been, the ahankara or the buddhi has totally been swallowed. In psychology, we say the ego has totally been swallowed by the unconscious. And so the unconscious projects out into the world, and the buddhi is within it, contained within it. There's no buddhi or ahankara outside. It's like, it's kind of like when you have a dream and you're identified with a character within the dream. Right? So now you're inside there. Right? Mm-hmm. So imagine that taking place outside, where the unconscious projects a reality onto the world, and your buddhi has no objectivity in reference to that projection. The buddhi is rather inside of it, or the ahankara is inside of it. And so part of the task is to, in working with somebody who has schizophrenia, there's many, all different kinds of methods that have been tried. But one method that one therapist uses, I forget the name of the person, tries to go into that space as though where the ego of the patient is tries to go into that reality and then lead him out, kind of like a shaman. You know, shamans, sometimes they feel the soul has been lost and they go to, they travel into astral realms in order to recapture that soul and bring it back out. It's kind of like, it's a little bit like that.
By going into their matrix space. And their world and mm-hmm. then bringing awareness for them. In
well, like guiding them out. Like say they're in a forum and somehow you guide them out and talking to them all the way until hopefully they can pop out of it. Mm. Though probably not permanently. Schizophrenia has a lot of physiological, chemical problems. So it's not just that the person became kind of mentally disturbed, like a normal mind becoming disturbed. It's not. Schizophrenia, there's some chemistry happening. The neurotransmitters and things are disrupted. It's more complex. It's not that easy to fix it. There are people who have had some success bringing a person out of a psychosis in that way. And I'm sure in many other ways, too, that would be the only way. Mm. That makes sense?
Yeah.
Mm. It's a skill. If someone doesn't have many questions around the world and the way things are, or maybe mean like about the world and the way things are, is it then enough to just recognize your being and to be able to rest the mind there? Well, you know, the Vedanta itself, the teaching methodology itself and going through the Upanishads and these various Prakarana Granthas that we did so far, we've done here, and the Bhagavad Gita also, and then we've done the Tathagata and the Panchadashi chapter one, and then these Upanishads. Most of the questions, the most common questions, maybe two or three tiers down, most common questions are really dealt with as part of the Sampradaya, as part of the teaching itself. And so many questions become answered for you. That's why a lot of times, I know many of you have said to me, and it certainly was my experience, is that you have a question, and then because of the logical sequence that takes place when this teaching occurs, that question arises only to be answered, right? Because the question arises within the logical sequence just at an appropriate time where the answer to that is naturally going to come. Those questions often are very natural and they're very naturally resolved. But some people have a lot, depends on the type of mind that you have. Some people have a very, very inquiring mind and think of all kinds of questions more than, I mean, everybody's different. You have to look at it. Everybody's very different. Some people have very few questions. You know, because the major questions that we would expect you to have are all covered, and the mind is just satisfied with those questions, maybe because of prior samskaras, you know, or the type of mind you have is more sees the bigger picture and is not like a Virgo going into all the little details. You'll know yourself. I mean, the doubts will. The doubts that cloud this vision, you know, can be fundamental to the vision, or they can be very detailed. It just depends on the person. A lot of doubts. Nobody would have thought of that doubt. Well, they probably have, actually, in some of these really texts, like the Vida, there's three or four of them. 1 minute, please. Naishkarma Siddhi. And then Advaita Siddhi. There's all these Siddhis. Naishkarma Siddhi, Advaita Siddhi, Brahma Siddhi. I think there's another one, too, that I can't remember. These go into extraordinary detail. You know, and the questions that they come up with are very esoteric. So Swamiji will call that, they've got a Vedanta Vasana. Mm. They have to calm down. Because it doesn't, I mean, but you can have a Vedanta Vasana, what we call Vedanta Vasana, it means that you're just addicted to studying the Shastra. You know, more than just really gaining this knowledge, what you love is to study the Shastra, and you want to study all of the Siddhis and all of these things and learn all, you need to learn all of the Darshanas thoroughly, and it's wow, on and on and on. But your mind gets kind of swept away in that, other than swept away in the vision itself, and into, that Upayanishta, where the issues that you have are something that you put your energy into working through those issues. Which in a way is the hardest part of it all. Because there's pain there. The study of the Shastra to a point is wonderful and necessary, and but then after a certain point it becomes a distraction. Because it's too tied to the texts and to picayune things. You can spend your life doing that rather than recognizing what these Shastras are pointing to as a pramana. So, something to keep in mind. Swamiji didn't talk about it very much, but he did talk about it. He didn't talk about it very much because he wanted us all to study. He wanted us all to study and to learn Sanskrit and be serious in our studies and all that. So he didn't want to discourage us. We have a Vedanta Vasana. But that's not what that means. It means that the study is taking place of gaining this vision and becomes a distraction.
Related to that question, I'm just thinking about, like, there's one thing of when the knowledge becomes clear, it naturally gets integrated into daily life. And then, you know, the question is about spending more and more time in contemplation or in silent meditation for a quickening of the shift of perception or shift of identity almost over to your real self instead of living in the periphery, so to speak. Would you say there's a strong correlation in much time you spend?
I would say what you're talking about is Nididhyasana, and that's exactly the reason that we do Nididhyasana. Nididhyasana also takes place at the time of teaching, but the whole point of Nididhyasana is to make that shift. Mm-hmm. Because you have, like, from beginning this time, being identified as a jiva, as this body, mind, sense organs, breaking your way through the world, trying to become happy. That's beginningless identification born of ignorance. And so you gain this knowledge, but everything in your psyche and all of the chitta, all the memories, everything are all geared around the ahankara. You know? And so Nididhyasana as a practice, as you're doing the shravana, manana, Nididhyasana, is really helpful for owning up yourself. But then, once yourself is owned up, there's really no time that you're not doing Nididhyasana. Because the self is self-evident. And you know, just like with the Kena Upanishad, yourself is the adhishtana of every thought that you have. It is actually the me, the conscious being, that every thought depends on, satyam mitya. So once you recognize yourself as that invariable, it's not something that you can not recognize. Once the viveka is there and you really recognize that, then there's no not recognizing it because it never changes, it's the invariable, and all the vrittis come and go, so there's no time that you're away from that. But then your mind can be, for some time, dragged out into the world, get kind of lost, and you've been as though dreaming out here, and you catch it, and then you just bring, you don't have to bring your mind back, you just recognize yourself at that moment. You know, and so say your mind is overactive in running after desires and doing this and doing that in a way that's problematic for you. It need not be problematic. It could be fine. You know, because it doesn't really cover, whatever your mind's doing doesn't really cover yourself. But say you feel that you get kind of lost, or your own presence gets lost by just the tendency of the mind to be running after desires or whatever. And initially there'll be some of that. And so there's this practice of bringing your mind back, which is just like it doesn't even take a second, not even a minute, a split second to do that, because there's no distance between the mind and you. So it's just an instantaneous thing. And so every one of those instantaneous moments is nididhyasana. So in that way, that kind of minimizes having to sit in meditation for long periods of time. On the other hand, just like there's some people who love to do and are drawn to doing puja, that's their, as though their bhakti or their devotion, how it expresses is in the doing of these very beautiful pujas like we do here. But that's their calling. For another person, that's a type of bhakti. Another person, it may be the study of the shastra. Another person, it can be nididhyasana. What you do is you do nididhyasana, and that's what you're drawn to. And so then such a person spends more time doing that. Another person spends more time doing pujas and chants and things like that. Another person spends time studying the shastra. Now, all of it brings about that integrated shuddhi. But people are different, you know. Some people are meditators, and they love to do that, and other people love other things. But they're just different expressions. It depends upon the person. So, what else to say about that? Keeping your buddhi, your mind, your emotions contained within this vision is what probably expedites the nishtha that takes place. That's true, but then what causes you to as though lose this vision is your raga dvesha and the problems in the mind, the ashuddhi, you know, the things in the mind that I have to work with, because they are what cause pain in the mind. And so that antakarana shuddhi, karma yoga buddhi is really probably the most important thing. Mm-hmm. I just say that because yourself is always completely present. In fact, there's never a time when nididhyasana is not there. But what happens is that the mind has pain, and that pain has to be handled. You know, it's causing you pain, you have to work with that. And you have to get to the source of what's causing that. So you can say everything you do, even nididhyasana, is for the sake of removing the pain. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And a little further on that, like once knowledge has started to take place, is there anything good in going for, you can say, exalted states of sattva? Like really cultivating sattva very strongly? Or could it be even better to not, because all the three gunas are in a way ropes, right? That it almost better to just kind of be in all walks of life with all kinds of people and in that way integrate the knowledge and see that it doesn't matter if I'm in a state of sattva or tamas or...
Well, I mean, In the end, that's completely true. Like, what if your drishti and your vision is that, you know, I have to, if I'm enlightened, I should only have sattva vrittis, you know. Oops, there's a tamas vritti. that just isn't true. The reason it's not true is those vrittis, all of them are mithya, whether it's sattva, rajas, or tamas. So, the thing that makes everything nirvikalpa samadhi is that yourself is totally self-evident and present in every vritti, and nothing can cover that because that viveka has been done, you know. And so then maybe just to tweak what you've said a little bit is that you can go experience hunting for different varieties of experience, and you need not at all. you could as well just sit home and do nothing. Because what the vrittis are always changing. It doesn't matter which vrittis there are. They're continually changing wherever you are. You know, but the thing that's not changing is you. And so when that is kind of that aparoksha, that self-evident me, is something that is never covered by the vrittis, then I don't have to go anywhere or do anything, and I can go everywhere and do everything. It doesn't really make any difference. You know, so I actually think what is more important or more productive, maybe, but there's nothing wrong with going everywhere, but that can be in your karma. You know, you're a person that loves to travel and experience all kinds of different things. And that's part of your probably, your karma and what you'll be doing with your life. You'll get to go on all these journeys and all that. But the thing that is obstructive and that you have to work with are the varieties of pains and agitations, the negative spectrum. Those things act as pratibandhakas. They take away from the mind the natural phala, natural fruit of having this knowledge. Even though it's a secondary fruit, the primary fruit being just primary fruit means result, like, so karma phala means what's the result of that karma. So the primary result of gaining this knowledge is the total recognition of the freedom of your being. You know, the absolutely present, invariable, changeless nature of yourself, recognizing yourself really as this Brahman. So seeing that clearly without any doubt, that is where the freedom really lies, not in the Shantavrittis. Shantavrittis are a secondary result of this knowledge. They become a secondary result because the main causes for agitation and hurt and frustration and anger and all of these is raga dvesha, where I need this to be happy. Those, for an Ajnani, these are real. I need to have this. I want to have this. Why? Because I need it to be happy and I need it to be whole and complete. And so those desires are taken very seriously, and of course they're not always fulfilled, or they're fulfilled but with a lot of stress involved, and so they create so much tension and agitation and sometimes rage and fury also. Murderous rage, because what you really believe that you need, somebody's taking from you. Like when we have all these wife beatings and all these horrible things. It's absolute rage, because what is yours, what you need to be happy, is being taken from you. And so those desires have to be converted into non-binding desires, where you're no longer projecting your ananda. And then you're free to have desires, but they have to be non-binding. If they're not non-binding, then they're ignorant and cause a lot of pain. But as long as you're alive, you will have non-binding desires, or you can't do anything. And the whole prarabdha so much is the swecha. It comes really from your own, the desires that are kind of part of the prarabdha karma that come through you, or they come through another person, or they come from the devatas, just from the creation itself. Mm-hmm. So that, I think, is where the work is. Like, say, for instance, if you're traveling around, having all different kinds of experiences, that becomes like that great, amazing, beautiful, wonderful appreciation of Ishwar. Until there's a negative experience, then that one becomes sadhana. Mm-hmm. But you don't really have to travel for your negative experiences. And you have less opportunity to have negative experiences when you travel. So I used to love to travel, because you leave everything behind and then you're just in wonderland, you know, because you're not connecting to any of these new experiences. You don't have any samskaras in reference to them, you know. No vasanas, no subtle likes and dislikes that are being triggered. And so you're like free when you get to travel. It's a beautiful experience. But then if you stop someplace and stay there for a while, then all of the, you know, things that start erupting, and then you, then there's the work to be done. So, yeah. I know the thought, I think. Also, also, this isn't about what you said, it's about something else. You know, it's kind of hard sometimes, it's harder, I think, to stay where you are. You know, because you're here, and you've got, there's just plenty of things to work on. I'll go and make sure, you know, that there's things for you to work on. And until they're all gone, those things will keep right coming up. It's just that way. I've told you the story about the Volvo, didn't I? You know, like say somebody's decided they're going to get a new car, and they've decided they want to get a Volvo. Okay. And so now, when they start, they've made the decision they're going to get a Volvo. Now, when they're driving around, all they see Volvos everywhere, because you've got Volvo on your mind, you know, so you see it everywhere. Before you decided to get a Volvo, you probably never even noticed them. But now you've got Volvo on the mind, so you see them everywhere. And I think that our problems are like that, too. If we have, like, an unconscious issue inside, it's there inside. And just almost, it's unconsciously, I suppose, unconsciously waiting there for something to trigger it. So that triggered it. Oh, that triggered it. That triggered it, you know? You see, you get triggered everywhere. And then when that problem is resolved, just because of your work and whatnot, it's resolved, then, of course, all of those triggers, the very triggers, they're all still there. But they're not triggers for you. They're triggers for somebody else. You know, so it's really not what's outside. It's what's inside. And when it's what... when it's inside, then you see it everywhere outside. I think that's really funny. I love the Volvo story. Because we wonder, you know, so many of myself included have said, you know, you finally get rid of this one person. So you've got this one person, a big troublemaker for you, you know. And as soon as you get rid of them, then another same thing happens, somebody else comes. Same problem. Yeah. That's because the problem's in you. Yeah, very funny. So the whole Antakarana Shuddhi thing is its primary. They're just two sides, you know, like they're two wings of the bird. And both wings have to be given their due.
Sometimes I feel, you know, you can either work things out by working with the issues,
yeah,
or you can kind of increase sattva in your life by certain practices. So would that, in one way, could that be seen as an escape? Or is that just an intelligence choice?
I don't see it as an escape unless you use it... in place of knowledge. And why I say that is because if you stop creating sattva in your life, it's kind of like, say you really have a wonderful yoga practice that creates, not only creates in pranayama and things, it creates a lot of sattva in your life, and it creates just a very well balanced body and all of these things. So with certain types of pranayama and meditation, you're full. Mind is just full of sattva, so you know. And so when that's true, when that's the case, things that may otherwise be a problem are not really noticeable to you because your mind is so kind of full of ananda. You know? But the problem is, if you stop doing that, and so now the sattva goes away, the tremendous benefits of yoga require that you do the yoga. You stop doing the yoga, then those really wonderful benefits no longer are there. And so then it's not that it's not useful, but it's something that you have to maintain. You know, so you're maintaining a high quality of body and mind so that you will have a certain sattva experiences. So, and that's true, you will, but you still have to maintain that. Whereas with self-knowledge, it's not at all about maintenance, because your self doesn't need to be maintained. You know, so it's changeless, it's invariable. It doesn't care if you do yoga or not. It doesn't make any difference. Mm-hmm. So that's not to say anything about doing or not doing yoga. In fact, you're better off to have an upadhi that has some yoga and pranayama and so understands some things about meditation, understands, has some consciousness or some education around what type of foods to eat, even. You know, what if you're eating just, you know, drinking big Cokes and eating sugar and, you know, eating terrible, terrible foods, and then you're trying to have a nice life when you're poisoning yourself? And I don't know, it's just a matter of kind of education and some discipline that you take care of your temple, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And it's a very smart thing to do, actually. But it's not moksha. But it creates an upadhi that is more conducive, has more able to, you know, even do nididhyasana, to have a mind that's available for this teaching, have a mind that has enough shanti for this teaching to just kind of pour in. So in that way, these are upayanishta. These are sadhanas, just like karma yoga is a sadhana, dharma is a sadhana. Doing this inner child work is a sadhana. Having a body and mind that are in healthy, vibrant condition, and a mind that has, you know, some control and some shanti. These are all really important things, but they're all dependent upon you maintaining them. And it's worth maintaining them at least until you get knowledge. You know? So that you can look at them as sadhanas, and then very helpful just for having a healthy, alert life. And having the mind have more shanti the mind has, the more happiness it has. But then what about your desires? You know? You can see people who have tremendous yoga and incredible pranayama, and they're just dragged ragged by their desires. So if you're a mumukshu and you're gaining knowledge and you do all of those things, it's really worthwhile. And otherwise, it's just worthwhile within samsara. It has its own thing. Mm. Follow?
Yeah, great.
Yeah. That's why we always have been saying the same thing for a while. It's time to stop. Noticing the silence. Can we say the silence that is there in and through the sounds is the Atma?
Mm-hmm.
Or like the Atma? The key here is the silence that's in and through the sounds is the invariable, you know? And to not objectify, we don't objectify silence, really. So one of the great things about japa is in the repetition of the mantra, like Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya. You first, when we're doing the mantra, you hear the sound. It's just as though you're listening. You hear the sound and then the silence. As though you hear the silence in contrast to the sound. You know, so that's almost like an objectifiable silence. You're hearing the silence versus the sound. So mantra silence, mantra silence, mantra silence. But after you do that for a while, there'll be a shift that takes place, and then you see the mantra silence taking place in silence. That silent backdrop. And so that silent backdrop is not objectifiable, that is just the self. The vritti is there because the sound itself, like the mantra, requires a vritti. So there's the vritti there, but the vritti silence is objectifiable in contrast. And that is different than the kind of the revealed silence in reference to the vritti. And that we say is the Atma. Does that make sense? Even now, at all times, there's whatever you're talking, whatever you're saying, whatever you're hearing, it's taking place in silence. And so in a way, there's always like, japa is always going on. Like each raindrop is a japa. Yeah. And you recognize it's a good meditation, actually, like an open-eyed walking meditation, where you just recognize the silence in which all of the activity, all of the sound, all sounds are taking place. Everything is taking place in this deep silence of the self. It's a deep, profound silence. So, japa is very useful to help you recognize that silence. Okay. I think we're only good for one or maybe two more. Indra had so much adhikaritvam that he understood very quickly what Uma taught him. But how could Indra later teach without being a Kshatriya? Yeah, it didn't sound in the verses like there was much teaching at all from Uma. There was hardly anything. Uma just went, it's Brahman. So, we have to fill in the story, I suppose. But also, Swamiji brought up in just a line, because this is just a story, you have to embellish the story. But one thing is that in the Devaloka, you know, there's so much sattva, it's just a different sphere, with the Antakarana not having so much kind of agitation and unconscious problems, because it's a more subtle loka where there's much more punya. It's a punya bhumi. Like to be Indra or Agni or Vayu or any of these devatas, it's really a punya bhumi, where here's a mix. This is 50-50 punya and papa. And below, it's primarily papa, different degrees of papa. And above us, it's more different, higher and higher degrees of punya. So in the Devaloka, there's much punya, so there's much sattva. There's not... Your presence, the adhishtana of your being, does not have an antakarana whose affects are conflicting. You know, like say for instance, yourself, just the me, that your own nature is what it is, and then sorrow, or depression, or anger, that is what it is, and so now in that case, say you have kind of this regular samsari mind that has anger and agitation, happiness and joy and frustration, and just a whole mix of things. Those vrittis, emotional vrittis or affects, are in a way competing or sharing space with just the silent ananda of your being, you know. And so that's why with Dharma, with Karma Yoga, with doing inner child work, the mind gains more and more sattva without the imposition of raga, of rajas and tamas, you know, without that being imposed on the vrittis. So that then that mind is more already, when the mind is primarily sattva, the mind is already like a clean mirror in reference to the self, or like a clear, polished sheet of glass in reference to your own being. So it's not competing at all. And so even though that superimposition, that ajnanam is there and the superimposition is there, when that mirror is held up, it doesn't take much to recognize your own self, because you're not carrying a lot of baggage, emotional baggage around with you, and pain in the mind and raga dvesha and all of this kind of stuff. It's not much there at all in that punya bhumi. Punya bhumi means you get pretty much what you want, and your body is very subtle, and the mind also doesn't have the same conflicts, the same papa that we have to deal with. So that mind gains knowledge very quickly. And the other devatas, they would gain knowledge very quickly also, because of the adhikaritvam, the level of qualification for that mind born in a punya bhumi. if we want to go that way and make that differentiation, which in reference to the story we do make that reason. Yeah. So they don't need as much teaching. Ramana was like a devata here because of the level of tremendous level of sattva. He did meditation, he did nididhyasana all the time, sat in samadhi all the time. And so when the teachers came to teach him, still didn't have self-knowledge, but when they taught him, it's like as they said it, he knew exactly what they were talking about, because there was no distance between his own being and what they were saying. No distance means in terms of things intervening, like worries and agitations. He was already always just, his mind was already resolving into himself, and so they were just describing him and then releasing him from the ajnanam and this anyonya adhyasa, this mutual superimposition that takes place until it doesn't. Till once it was said, that was enough. Shweta Ketu, also in the Chandogya Upanishad, once it was said, he had to be told the same thing 12 times. Yeah. But that's how long it took, and that was enough. He just walked off. But this is Kali Yuga, and we take longer. And we have more things to work through. if we became mumukshus when we were in Indra, or we were in a Devaloka, then it would be much easier. But you, not last time you were Indra, you weren't a mumukshu. That's the problem. Or last time you were in that Devaloka, you weren't a mumukshu. Yeah. I think it'd be harder to become a mumukshu in Devaloka when you're getting everything that you want. But of course, you could have already had the samskaras from your last lives. Those samskaras don't go away, you just pick up the thread. Mm-hmm. Whatever. One more. I feel like it's raining, so we have to stop early. Well, what logic is that? Please specify. What do I invite in and welcome, and what do I give back to Ishwara? Well, I always let whatever is coming up, I always welcome it so as not to push it away. I welcome it so that then I can work with it and try to transform it. And you can't really do that if you're if you have an attitude of pushing away, as though that's some sort of an unmentionable type of person, you know, that you just don't want anything to do with it. That's also not right. If you welcome it, then you can be with it, you can pray, you can talk about it with Bhagawan. And one meditation we do at the farm is because there's a very rapid river, small, like a creek, stream, very rapidy stream. And so we go up to where that stream is, and we sit around it, and it's quite noisy. And so we offer, just a meditation, we offer whatever that issue is into the stream as Ishwara, and let it become purified in the stream. It's like offering it a puja, same idea where you would offer that problem to Bhagawan as part of the puja, you know, and then let Bhagawan purify it and then give it back to you that comes back in a different form. And it really does come back in a different form. It's very kind of magical, or, you know, because the form that it comes back in, that Bhagawan gives it back to you in, is very meaningful. It's almost like telling you this is how to deal with that. You know? And so it's not about not accepting all of the things, because you can accept all of the things to work on them and make them better. I think that in this question, in a little way, it's getting mixed up with acting out. See, what do I invite in and welcome, and what do I give back to Ishwara? None of it you act out on, right? And so giving back to Ishwara, if you say like that, then you welcome it, to offer it to Ishwara to help with it, to help transform it. Right? you don't welcome. Like say if you have somebody that you really don't like, and so you do an imaginal meditation where you imagine that person, you welcome them. You don't try to push them away at all. Because usually with the people that are situations you don't like, so you want to avoid them, keep them away. But now there's a meditation where you don't try to keep them away. You allow them to be with you. Like sometimes I have that little mantra, it's okay, you can be with me. And it's really talking from the standpoint of the self, you can be with me. And then your heart becomes bigger. So that's why you do that, because your heart becomes bigger that way. But you're not, it's not like, it has nothing to do with acting out. It has to do with transformation, that welcoming. And then offering to Bhagavan, because it's a problem that's tenacious for you, that you have a hard time solving or healing, then you can give the whole thing to Bhagavan in a prayerful way and ask him to help and purify that problem and give it back to you. And that's really a nice meditation.
Om swasti prajapyah paripalayantam nyayena margena mahim mahishah ko brahmane pyashubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu varjanyah prithivi sasya shalini Desho yam shobharitaha Brahmana santu nirbhayaha Om sarvesham swastir bhavatu Sarvesham shantir bhavatu Sarvesham purnam bhavatu Sarvesham mangalam bhavatu Sarve bhavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha Sarve bhadrani pasyantu Ma kaschit dukkha bhag bhavet Asato ma satkamaya Tamaso ma jyotir gamaya Mrityor ma amritam gamaya Om purnamadah purnamidam purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om